For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So, good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have given a talk this evening, Brian Taylor, who is always preparing for lay ordination here at Ancient Dragon. He's also going to be our new work leader starting sometime towards the end of the year. And he's also an Episcopal priest, so he has a number of different hats, and he's agreed to speak to us tonight. So thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you, Taigen, for inviting me to speak. And thank you also for the memorial that we just took part in here and for your words at the beginning. As I was preparing this talk and the week's events were unfolding and it was affecting me in such a disturbing way as it has for so many people, I began to feel as if what I had to say tonight was trivial, and perhaps I should be talking directly about these events. And then what came to mind was that suffering takes all kinds of forms, and there is social suffering in the form of poverty and injustice and violence, and there's personal suffering that happens in the form of grief and depression, anxiety, chronic physical pain, all sorts of things. And so the difficulty of what's happening in our nation right now around poverty, violence, and race is in the room. And I'm glad it remains in the room, and it's related to whatever difficulties each one of us also has in more personal forms. And so I'm going to address the latter. And I want to talk about how Dharma and practice have helped me in a time of difficulty, and with the knowledge that the Dharma helps all forms of suffering, whether they're personal or social. Siddhartha Gautama went from his house of luxury to outside in the world, and it's reported that he saw old age, disease, and death. What he saw was impermanence, change, loss as a reality, and began eventually to see that our denial of these factors in life is a cause of suffering. And this teaching on impermanence and suffering became central to the Dharma. Another central teaching is that of emptiness, which is the absence of the fiction of having separate substantial self-existence. And these two teachings, impermanence and emptiness, have been extremely helpful to me in the last few years. They've not been abstract ideas. They've been realities that I've tried to live with and that have made a huge difference in terms of maybe not my physical survival, but certainly my mental, my sanity. And I'm grateful for that. During many years of studying and practicing Zen and contemplative prayer, I always reflected on these kinds of teachings, impermanence and emptiness, in my day-to-day circumstances, and looked at the fact that jobs and job situations, relationships, problems, little losses gave me opportunities to learn about impermanence and emptiness. And the self also being in flux and not some sort of a permanent thing. And we always chant, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Daily circumstances are those Dharma gates that give us those opportunities to really learn the Dharma and benefit from the teachings. But looking back, my challenges up until a few years ago, were relatively subtle. And the Dharma gates were, you know, one way of picturing them for me was that they were like the gate in a white picket fence, which I could kind of choose to go through at times. But a few years ago, life circumstances changed, and they became much more dramatic, and the stakes were raised, and it really became life and death. The Dharma gates at that point were more like those, you know, big creaky iron gates to Mordor or Paradise, with guards and attack dogs and secret passwords. And the going through those gates was not a walk in the park at all, but arduous and a matter of life and death. It was time, I realized, to either take the Dharma and my practice seriously or not. As it says on the Han in the entryway out here, life and death is the great matter. Don't waste time. Well, it was time. Because in a year's time, a few years ago, I had a crash course in impermanence and emptiness. Several things happened in the course of that year. I retired after 30 years in one position. There was the death of both of my parents, an alienation from one of my siblings. My wife's beloved younger brother took his own life. My mother-in-law accidentally lit a major fire in the ancestral family home of 185 years north of Boston. I left my friends, my history in Albuquerque, and I moved to Chicago knowing barely anyone except for my son and his friends. And most disturbing, my wife's health, which was and continues to be a progressive condition, and there was and is the ongoing danger of losing her. So all of this at once. And, you know, I've always loved music and done music, and one of the things that's always occurred for me since I was a child was tunes going through my head that I would think about, and I realized that the words to those tunes had a lot to do with what I was experiencing. And I'd come up with these tunes that carried some kind of meaning forward. And the tunes that were going through my head during that time when I moved to Chicago a couple of years ago were, one of the songs was the lyric, "A complete unknown, no direction, home." A song that I believe is about adoption called "Ain't One Soul in the Whole World Knows My Name." And another one from the that was from a movie in recent years. "I used to be somebody, now I am somebody else." What became very real was the loss of the fiction of self-existence, permanent self-existence. What became very real was the fragile and transitory and unpredictable nature of this life. And that happened through a loss of meaning, relationship, persona, stability, self. It was profoundly disorienting. And every day, all day, I was faced with the question, who or what am I? What am I doing? Do I need to be somebody? Do I need to be doing something in particular? Is everyday life enough? And fortunately, this is when you came along. And for that, I'm very grateful. Always will be. My career, as Taigen mentioned, was as the senior priest of a busy Episcopal congregation for 30 years. I was never completely identified with my work. I was never very churchy. And so I didn't see myself in that role all the time. We used to joke about how some clergy would probably go to bed in their collars if they could, if their wives let them. But I was never like that. And I had friends outside the church always. I was always interested in and a student of Zen. Still, I was part of an institution. And I was living out of a kind of an all-encompassing big persona as a leader. I had a clear sense of purpose and a role in society and a clear mission in terms of my work life, and that took up a lot of mental and emotional space. So when that ended cold turkey, my brain was a bit frantic for about a year, casting about for something to take its place, even though I didn't really want that. The brain was still looking for purpose or meaning or something that would fulfill its habitual way of behaving. And so I asked myself, well, maybe I should get a PhD and that'd be a teacher. Maybe I should, I've always done music, maybe I should do full-time music and then I'd be a musician. Maybe I should do more writing than I've already done and then I'd really see myself as an author. Maybe I should give myself full time to being a retreat leader because I've done a lot of that, and that will be my new vocation. But nothing got traction. This was all like just going down these dead ends and hitting a brick wall at the end. Nothing was appealing. So it was like standing still with the engine running, you know, and not going anywhere. Or another image that came to mind at the time was what I've heard described by some amputees as phantom limb syndrome, that you still feel the feelings of the limb that's no longer there as if it is there. So I began to wonder, what if everyday life is all there is for me now? I've always said that's where it really, that's what really matters. I've always said that, always taught that. Why isn't it, or is it? What if I don't have any purpose, any kind of forward-thrusting momentum, you know? What if I really do become a nobody, forgotten, aimless? I had a dream during this time. I don't have very many really strong dreams that I remember, but once in a while one just jumps out, and this was one of those. I was in a rehearsal for a television show, and all of the elements of the filming of the show were there. All the minor roles, the plot, the director, the lighting, the set, except for one thing, and the one thing that mattered most. There was no lead part. There was no person to fill the lead part that was supposed to happen. The director told me, we don't know what we're going to do. There's no lead part, and that lead part holds everything together. And that was really the end of the dream. I was left wondering, would the show go on without a lead part? How could it? And really the question was, how can I go on without a lead part, without a role? So I decided to just try to live with the emptiness and not try to fix it, and not try to find something else to fill its place. And not run around trying to make friends and do all these things that would, you know, fix all these difficulties I was having. It was painful, but very gradually the idling engine slowed down and stopped. The phantom limb syndrome faded away, if you will, and things gradually shifted. And this was really directly because of what Zen practice and teaching how they have helped me and my engaging with them. And so I hope that some of what I say might speak to you in terms of ways in which the Dharma and practice help you when you are suffering and when you're having a difficulty in your life. The teaching of impermanence became very real for me, and it became a practice really of grief, of loss, a practice of living with the anxiety of unknowing, knowing that the future is the present is different from the past, the future will be different from now, and I can't control that. There was for me a practice of sadness in really understanding this in a way that I never had before. And it wasn't about letting go of permanence, because I sometimes feel like maybe we don't ever let things go. Maybe we just wear them out. They get thin, you know, kind of transparent, less controlling of us. But gradually learning to accept a different viewpoint, that life is impermanent and that change is inevitable and that I can't control the future, and I don't know what the future is going to be. Nothing is forever. And so I think I gradually learned to say yes to that as a different viewpoint than one that I was really used to. In Zazen, we can see that up close. Things are constantly shifting in our body and mind and heart, in the environment around us, in the room that we're sitting in. Things are constantly changing. And I think because I'm retired and I have a lot more time, I was able to practice with impermanence by becoming more attuned to the subtleties of what was happening, whether in my mind, in my mood, in the weather around me, the circumstance, the people around me on the street, the things that were coming my way in terms of circumstances. And really, I began to enjoy bringing a sense of curiosity to that changing landscape within and around me. I like the word evanescence. Evanescence is a word that suggests that things are fragile and fleeting, but perhaps because of that, all the more beautiful. And so bringing a curiosity to that was very helpful. And this was different from, you know, times in the past. I would know that things were changing, that things are impermanent, but I had this momentum in terms of going through life, and especially in my work life, of productivity and a kind of inner constancy that was necessary to get things done as things were changing around me. But now I was able to be more a part of the impermanence that was happening and let myself be influenced by it and be at the same time responsive to it. The teaching of emptiness is very related to impermanence, of course, because it's not just deconstructed nothingness, it's not a void, but a lack of a separate permanent self-existence that somehow has a solidity to it. It questions the view of the world made up of objects, including the self as just one more object, and rather it sees things as an interrelated field of activity, of phenomena, all of it arising, evolving, passing on, and reemerging together. And so the practice was really, during this time, feeling myself in this way, feeling what I call self in this way, as only one phenomena among all other phenomena. And one of the images that came to mind during that time was like being one instrumentalist in a vast symphony. And this big symphony is going on all the time, and it's constantly changing, and you don't really know where the music is going. But all you are is one instrument, or maybe your consciousness is one instrument. It's not the soloist. You're not carrying the whole thing. It's just, you know, the third flute playing a little thing once in a while that adds to the whole. And really beginning to experience myself like that, rather than some sort of a soloist who's carrying this melody by myself. One of the things that occurred to me during this time was how we talk about the weather as if there's a thing called the weather. You know, the weather is good, the weather is bad, the weather is changing, the weather is cold. There's no subject of that sentence. There's just things happening. There's coldness, there's heat, there's rain. Things are weathering. And in the same aspect, I began to realize that there's no Brian. There is Brianing that's happening. Only moods, activities, relationships, and changing circumstances, the five skandhas. So in Zazen, again, we have a concrete, immediate experience of this emptiness. A thought arises, and we ask ourselves, after it's passed, where is it now? Does it have any substance? No. Who thought that? Is there somebody there now that was thinking that? No. And sometimes one of the most helpful things for me in Zazen is to experience this kind of almost like being floating and suspended in the air, nothing to hang on to. It's a very vulnerable state sometimes. There's this gravitational pull that wants to condense things down to an imagined self and an imagined thought and solution or idea or plan or something that our little brain is doing to concretize the self in that moment. But to then let it open up again is this kind of floating, suspended space where there's nothing to hang on to. And it's very vulnerable, but it's very liberating and very real. And so that's one of the ways that I practiced with emptiness in Zazen, was to let go of this concretizing self. Finally, one practice has been during this time watching that habitual tendency or urge to create a new persona, as I mentioned earlier. And one of the most insidious of those is to become a really good Zen student, a diligent one who is involved here. You know, there's nothing wrong with diligence and being a good Zen student, but not in order to be a new something. And I could feel sort of that pull towards that in order to replace something that was gone. At the end of the last session, we were all asking questions of Taigen, and my question to Taigen came out of preparing for Jukai this fall later on. And the question was, how do I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha without being attached to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? And he paused and said, that's the path. Enjoy Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It is your ideas about them that creates the attachment to them. And I've taken that as a wonderful teaching for life itself, to enjoy our life, to enjoy our everyday experience, to enjoy whatever's coming up, whatever it is we're committed to and passionate about, whatever we choose to engage with, to enjoy it and to see what emerges in this empty, impermanent place. And not get too stuck in our ideas about all that. That's the shift that has happened for me in the last few years. To be able to really focus on not so much what I'm doing, but how I'm doing what I'm doing. With attention, curiosity, commitment, flexibility, responsiveness, a kind of a light touch, so that everything is not only okay, it's very interesting. And I'm finding that that's purpose and mission enough. But to close, Dogen in the Genjo Koan put this all a lot better and more succinctly. When he described a shift from the delusion of carrying ourselves forward and experiencing myriad things to the awakening of myriad things coming forth and experiencing themselves.
Thank you, Brian, for sharing.
You're welcome.
Comments? About that light touch and just being interested in what's going on and not having to make it into something. That's good. So actually, what's happening? How am I doing here? How am I enjoying it? And thank you for sharing it so personally.
Thank you. You're welcome. Yes.
Thank you. That's a lot to think about. think about. And I guess my comment is just that, I'm working on that myself. It's not easy to let go of that sense of self. I mean, I can see it's there, but just seeing it's there so far hasn't led to being able to let it go.
One of the ways in which I've heard that statement about the great matter of life and death is, and this may be just an issue of aging. I'm in my mid-60s. I just retired. And this may be an issue of aging, that we're inevitably headed towards death. And, the question becomes, I'm not going to be of this or of that in old age, in death. So what is it then? Yeah.
I was going to concur that I feel like I'm going through something very similar. I would say maybe I'm at a young age.
Yeah.
For me, I'm going through something similar where I was something. And the last 3 or 4 years, three of those years, including my time coming here, have been what is next, sitting and kind of waiting. And I love your metaphor of the engine running and not going anywhere. What's it going to be like? And then you just kind of kept talking. You didn't really go into specifics. And then you eventually went back to the metaphor and said, the car went from being in, ready mode to going idle. And in peace with that. And I was like, okay, wasn't what I was expecting. But in terms of impermanence and emptiness,
respond to Kespi, that I've had many people come to me who aren't as old as Brian, be in that space of, what's next and what should I do, as you've talked to me about. And but I think what Brian was saying is helpful, that to be curious, to not be in a hurry to find something or to rush around to find something, but also to look at what it is that calls you and try things and, something. It doesn't have to be some calling, like Brian was saying, that you hold on to, but to look at what actually you enjoy and find interesting and, see where that takes you. So we do find places to hang out, but it's not like the ultimate, it's not like it's that you exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's different at different times.
I was curious, in your many years of experience as a priest, you talk about that identity, it's created, and I've been a priest for 4 years now. There was something liberating with kind of letting go of something old and stepping into this, and part of it was me was taking a new name too,
mm-hmm.
something fresh. But after a few years, it's not like I lost some sense of self, it's just like I can see how now my sense of self is just almost more tied up with this role of Zen priest. at times. So, do you have any advice? How to not get caught?
I would go back to what Taigen said to me. Enjoy it. It's your ideas about it that cause the attachment. One of the questions I used to get in some trouble now and then in the church, and one of the questions that I always ask myself is, what if you get deposed? What if you're no longer
defrocked?
Yeah, what if you can't do this any longer? What if they kick you out, And maybe that's a useful meditation for you.
Who are you without?
Well, what would it be like? I mean, does that raise fear? Does it what is it a sense of who am I if I'm not this? I don't know. I mean, for me, it was a useful thing to meditate on once in a while. Yeah.
I do enjoy it.
Yeah, good, good, good. Yes, David.
Where I thought right away was, okay, I'm being brought to court and I have to speak the truth.
Uh-huh.
What am I going to say?
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, no, it's interesting because I don't read much about practice. I start a lot of books and I don't finish them. And I hear you talking and I'm saying, God, I should be doing that. You know, I should, you know, like I want to get the, you know, that whole thing about. Yeah, what you say is about being in the moment, just enjoying that moment and not hanging on to some idea I have of myself, who I should be.
Right.
Who I am. Just enjoying the moment. And having gone through a divorce and left 3 years very tough at times, and I find myself more contented just being in the present. Just
Yeah, yeah, you're welcome. Well, loss comes all the way through life. I mean, and it doesn't matter what age we are, we experience loss, all of us in different ways. And it's hard for us human beings to go through loss. And I think that some of these teachings are amazing resources to practice with during those times of loss. And they do have to do with questions of identity and lots of other things that they raise.
Two responses. One, going back to what Aksha was saying, we're never just one thing.
Right.
You know, we have many, you know, we may have one kind of calling or identity, oh, Episcopal priest or whatever, or Zen priest, but we all have many interests and, you know, kind of senses and relationships, and I think it's good to see the varieties of what, who, how we are. So that's one thing, just, you know, to actually kind of move around in that. That's one thing. But then you were talking now about the sadness, and going back to what, you know, I was talking about, and David and I being at the Black Lives Matter demonstration, and just, you know, what we're all going through with the sadness of been happening, and you were referring to this in the beginning, just part of, and your the sadness of all the changes that you were going through kind of all at once, and your wife's illness and many things. And part of our practice, the first noble truth, is just facing the sadness, not trying to fix it and figure out what to do to make it good, make it all right, but just that we can sit and face the wall and face ourselves, and you know, whatever it is, our personal situations of sadness, or just, you know, for our country, the, you know, the karma and legacy we have of slavery and racism and all the other things, you know, injustice. But each of us, being willing to sit in the sadness and just be there with it and face it, there's a power to being willing to face it. So that's part of what you were testifying to in terms of talking about your story and the difficulty of it, but it's also, you know, we get into fear and anger and hatred, and, you know, if we can just get rid of the Mexicans or the Muslims or whoever, then we'll be okay. All of that fear and hatred is a screen for actually just, you know, there's something in my life that just doesn't work and it's sad. Can you just be with that? On so many levels, personal, social.
Well, what comes to mind as you're speaking is that I think sometimes the impulse, which is so strong in our culture, the American culture, to find a solution and to spring into action, to change something, to make it better, which has a lot of good in it, that impulse sometimes what's the word for it? It bypasses necessary work that is deeper, if that's all we're doing, yeah. is looking for a solution. And for me, in this situation that's personal, I felt that if I were to find a new persona, I would still feel some of the disorientation and alienation underneath it that really had come up because I was facing this reality of emptiness and impermanence. And if I didn't really look at that, then it was still going to be there anyway. So I might as well just do that. And I think, you know, in relating to social issues, that one of the things that's been occurring to me during this time is in the last few months has been there is some inner work around nonviolence in terms of carrying our own divisiveness and hatred and self-righteousness or whatever it is in our hearts that is a source of external violence. And it's not that you do one or the other in terms of addressing it externally or internally, but you can't bypass the internal reality of hatred and divisiveness within each of us and think you're going to fix things by changing the world around you.
I would just add that that's maybe what's hard about that, because it's not getting elected to some funny position. What's difficult about sustaining this is being willing to look at that stuff, you know, in here, you know, and around us. You know. But it's something we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It hurts to see our own craving and fear and sadness and all that. But it's awesome.
I wouldn't have been able to do this in the last 3 years without you, all of you, and without this practice, without this place, without the Dharma. I mean, it is possible to do with a little help from our friends.
Well, on that note, maybe we'll do our last song.
These are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Are inexhaustible.